Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Blair Lewis. I am the president of Global Recruiters Network in Mid-Cities. We specialize in financial services, placing of executive roles. A lot of what I work on are C-level positions within either asset management or wealth management firms. And I'm happy to be on the podcast today.
That's awesome, Blair. Thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. I want to spend some time talking about your current role, the current organization. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date and major accomplishments.
Yeah, so came out of college at Texas A&M and became a financial advisor and was really terrible at that. As a 24-year-old, couldn't really handle the pressure of managing people's retirements and things of that nature. But I liked the industry, so I ended up finding a role where I sold to financial advisors. That role is commonly called a wholesaler. And I did that for about 20 years. And in 2008, 2009, when we had the big economic pullback, that job became a lot more detailed, as you might imagine, John. It was a situation in which everyone wanted to know everything within their portfolio, whether or not it had derivatives in it, that type of thing. And it became much less relationship driven and much more investment vehicle driven. And so I kind of wanted to phase myself out at that time. It took me about 4 or 5 years to do so and created a recruiting firm just solely based on the fact that I had had 3 jobs in my career and they had all come from a recruiter. And so I had a high degree of respect for the position, but every recruiter I had ever had was more like, hey, here's the opportunity. Let me send you this. And they didn't have any personal experience in the space. So my value proposition was, well, what if someone actually had had those roles before? What if someone understood what it was like to walk in those shoes? Would that be a more effective recruiting experience? So I created my company in 2012, and we just celebrated our 8th anniversary back in February. And slowly, the accomplishment would be that we were working on very introductory positions, new things as people were kind of breaking in to the industry. And then over time, people began trusting me and my team with larger and larger projects. And so we've been able to sort of work our way up the ladder to the executive level. But I think the biggest accomplishment that I've had so far is we have been able to run the firm and fill the roles with 100% satisfaction. When we haven't had satisfaction, we've gone back to replace that candidate or to make it right. So to still be in business and to be thought of well and get referred business and things of that nature is probably the biggest accomplishment.
Oh, that's exciting. And thanks for sharing kind of the backstory on your career timeline. So you've mentioned, what is it now, 8 years you've been with the current company when you've been building that, which is major accomplishment. Congratulations on that. Share with us a little bit, you know, about the mission of your current organization. What are you guys trying to accomplish? What are the objectives?
Yeah, so the objectives of our roles were a little different in the objective category, because we are not consultants to the business. A lot of times the business already has the need that needs to be filled, and maybe they've called or exhausted their own lead source, and so they need an outside influence to come in, vet candidates, and move forward. So a lot of times our goals are internal. You know, we want to increase revenue or client satisfaction or the turnaround time from the beginning that someone gives us a job rec to the time that we have it filled and someone's in the seat. But because I'm not part of the organizations and I work outside of them, a lot of our goals are completely internal. So this year, what we're trying to accomplish is we had about a 5-month vacation last year. with COVID. No one hired for a few months. And so I learned how to garden. I started two podcasts. It was a little bit of a mess. So this year's goal was to stay engaged all 12 months and sort of best our 2019, which up to that point was our record year. So we are sort of resetting based on 2019, just because last year was such a weird year for a recruiting firm.
No, that's very interesting. And from, you know, your expertise in staffing and in talent acquisition in this space, what are some of the trends that you have been observing or researching lately that, you know, you're very passionate about, or something that really helps you predict kind of at least what's the next curve is looking like? Share with us your thoughts from that perspective.
Yeah, the industry that I recruit in has gone through a lot of changes. In 2016, the Department of Labor really got involved and began to sort of do something that, you know, we would term saber rattling, but began showing their power in terms of trying to get everyone to realize that when you're in the investment community, you need to work as a fiduciary, which means you should care as much about your client's money as you do your own, right? Invest as if you're investing on your own. And one of the reactions to that was a lot of firms began to really worry whether or not they were charging too high a fee for asset management. And so what you've seen since 2016 to today is just a ever, you know, trending line of expenses and management fees going to essentially zero. Now, you know, Schwab has recently come out with a 0%, you know, expense account. And so how does a firm react to that with thinner and thinner margins? And the answer is, well, you can't make a lot of hiring mistakes. You need to engage your people and really focus on employee retention and development instead of always feeling like you could train people from the outside and sort of adjust on the fly. People are having to be much more reliant on technology and integrating that technology across all the channels of the business to create efficiencies of scale. And so as I look at the future, the trends that have really got me excited are just better and better, more integrative CRM systems that work across all the divisions. When I first started in the business, the CRM system, you know, was only for the sales team. And it had very little to do with operations, compliance, et cetera. Those walls have really been torn down as these systems have integrated to create communication across the different channels. So that plus artificial intelligence and being able to make decisions quicker. Now with COVID, the advent of people being able to work from home and integrating that technology from home and being able to access that through the cloud, all of those changes have really happened in about a 5-year period within my industry, which has caused us to, you know, really have to rely on being agents of change, being quick to adapt to new technologies. Make sure you're not the last one sticking around, you know, trying to sell the buggy whip.
Right. No, absolutely. Those are very interesting trends. And, you know, as I work with a lot of my clients, a lot of conversations we're having is around how the organizations are structuring basically their entire operations, whether continuing in the full remote capacity or building some type of a hybrid, you know, model as we're coming out of the pandemic. What are you seeing? What are you recommending to some of the, I guess, client companies that you partner, you collaborate with?
Yeah. That's been a difficult thing. So as I said, you know, people weren't hiring for a while, and a lot of people lost their jobs during the pandemic and didn't have work, couldn't go see clients, et cetera. And so it became a market in which if you had a good opportunity, it was easy to recruit someone. Well, the market quickly corrected. We began seeing people after Labor Day, firms began hiring. Then when the election was behind us and then a vaccine was announced, all of a sudden everyone was hiring. And now that whole thing has been flipped. Now it is a candidate-driven marketplace. The positions are open, but the candidates that were on the sidelines have gone back to work. So you've got these growing firms with growing needs that are having difficulty just finding available people on the street. That is exactly the situation I like as a recruiter, because that means it's hard to find people. We should hire an expert. And so as we're looking forward, And going forward into the new reality, what we're encouraging people to do is allow more work from home, allow them to integrate with the technologies from home. Even if it's not 5 days a week, you never see this firm. We've integrated with some firms and worked with them where they're doing a Monday, Wednesday, Friday routine, and they're actually having a cleaning crew come in and clean the offices at night. Someone else goes in on Tuesday and Thursday, and they're doing office sharing. So they've been able to move into smaller spaces and be able to, you know, save on overhead and things of that nature. But really, a lot of what we're trying to focus on from our standpoint on employee retention is keeping them engaged, allowing them to work from home, and really being able to promote from within. The single largest reason that people leave their position is they don't believe that there's a career path up. They were promised one thing during the interview process, and they get there and they're looking around, and like John over there has been in the same position for 8 years and I've been there for 10 minutes. You know, what? How am I going to compete against that? And so being able to change that culture to developing talent from within, that is the major thing that we work on with our hiring managers on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, I agree, it's very challenging. And at the same time, it's takes a lot of experimentation as well. And with bringing workforce back to the physical offices also adds another layer of complexity with, you know, increased anxiety and also adapting to the new conditions. I think that's, you know, a problem on its own. So that's going to be interesting how a lot of companies deal with that in the next period. You've mentioned briefly about, you know, the whole concept of kind of the, not really the war for talent, which is pretty, you know, pretty intense, especially these days with a lot of companies competing for a lot of similar talent for their organizations. But retention aspect also becomes of utmost importance for organizations to really hold on to their, you know, top performers. What are some of the recommendations or, you know, practical strategies that you have seen other companies successfully implement versus others when it comes to retaining top talent?
Yeah, I think with top talent, they want to feel like they participate in the growth of the organization. So we've begun to see a trend away from set bonuses and more equity style bonus programs. And so bringing in, especially at the level that we recruit, where a lot of the people we're recruiting are the head of operations or a COO or something like that, just sitting down with base trend lines of where the organization has been from a profitability and revenue growth standpoint and hiring someone and saying, hey, everything beyond this level that we experienced anyway before you got here, we're going to tie you into that. And oftentimes it's cash, you know, cash bonuses or cash compensation rather than actual equity, because a lot of times the owners of a firm don't want to give up ownership. But making them feel as though they are tied to the results that they're driving within the organization has been the number one thing that we have seen retain talent as of recently. I was just on the phone, John, before we got on, and was speaking with a gentleman who's been the president of a firm. It's grown from you know, its infancy stage to $6.5 billion under management, making it a large registered investment advisory firm. And for 5 years, he's been there for about 15, but for 5 years, he's been promised equity. And for 5 years, every year, they come up with a new reason as why not to tie him in. Well, now here's a guy who's helped them grow the firm, like I said, from the very beginning. And he is actively engaging with someone like me saying, hey, I want to find a firm that not only do I have a seat at the table, but they reward me as such. And so I think the ability to share the wealth, the ability to recognize where growth comes from and reward the people who drive that is one of the biggest hurdles we have to overcome in order to retain top talent and keep people engaged for a longer period of time. Because no one wants to hire someone whose resume is 2 years here, 2 years there, 3 years there. Everyone wants to see 5+ year stays. My answer to that is, well, you tie them in to the success of the business, make them feel rewarded, and they'll stay, you know, for a career.
Right. Absolutely. No, that's a great example that you gave with that particular individual getting their equity dragged out. Is, you know, it's just so unfortunate and very, you know, in my view, very short-term thinking, in a sense, not really investing in that type of talent, which, you know, when someone is talented, they always going to find another opportunity, and not showing that appreciation, especially early stages. It resonates so well because I've been there myself, and I was, you know, upset at the time, but it actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise, where a lot bigger opportunities opened up that I wasn't so stuck with that particular situation. So that's kind of was the outlook from that perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, no matter how I tell this to my my college age daughter all the time, I said, no matter how life works out, it always ends up working out, right? For good or for bad, it's just going to work itself out. And so being in situations that you can control, and being in situations which you're rewarded for, you know, the good results of being able to control it, that's all you can focus on. Everything else is sort of out of your control. So spending your effort and energy, trying to control something uncontrollable is the first way to, you know, create misery in your life. And so, yeah, you've got to find the people in your life that reward you. And so employers are the same way. When they hire someone who immediately adds value and they feel like, wow, this is a great addition, well, they should quickly begin thinking about how to tie that person in with the success of the firm and make them feel rewarded. Because the days of here's your base salary, and then you can have a discretionary bonus up to 15% of that. That's what causes people to leave every 3 or 4 years and just realize, okay, I'm not going to get the growth that I'm looking for here. And to your point, John, when you said it's short-sighted, oftentimes it's just selfish, and it's not wanting to share in something that you haven't had to share in, you know, up to this point. But I think times are changing and people are starting to demand that. And the more information that is out there, and the easier it is to open your own practice or go and compete against the people that you're working for right now, the greater the need is to learn to do that.
Right. No, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. What are your thoughts on, you know, the growth and evolution of the whole concept of contingent workforce? The reason I ask about this particular, you know, segment is because I've seen a lot of companies, the need for ability to scale up or down in a very fast, efficient, agile manner. And a lot of organizations, you know, structuring portion of their workforce in from that contractor, gig worker, consultant perspective. What have you seen in the market these days? What are your thoughts overall on kind of the contingent workforce?
Yeah, and that's really an area in which I do not specialize. Everything that I do is permanent placement. So I see a lot of staffing, and I see that on people's resumes, but it's not where I spend. So I wouldn't be able to really lend you any expertise in that. Unfortunately, John, I kind of work in a different space. And so I see the trend line is definitely, you know, up. I think the difficulty has been when I have hired people who've done that is if they're working on their own and building out their own consulting, it's been very difficult for them to maintain the same standard of living that they did working for another firm, because a lot of times they're just not good salespeople. And, right, you know, that's not what they do. But yeah, I can't really speak to, the overall trend line on that.
No, that makes perfect sense. When you collaborate with an organization to find a particular skill set for based on their need, when it comes to preparation for, you know, the actual interview and that initial conversation, I would imagine you work on both sides. You prepare the hiring manager for, you know, the option of the interview, and then obviously the candidate as well. Share with us, what are some of the practical strategies that really help you increase that batting average, so to say, when it comes to successful preparation and execution of the interview process?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I recommend to both sides, and John, you're right, a lot of times I feel like a kid whose parents are fighting, and I'm like negotiating with both and trying to smooth it out. But the biggest thing that I find is there is what you say you want and that you need to fill the role, and then you interview based completely on other factors. It's you interview based on likability, your ability to bond with someone, the sharpness or the quickness of which they answer, or their personality. And it's difficult to train people to interview for what they're looking for. And so my work with the hiring manager is the first time I recruit for someone, I sit in on the interview. So a lot of our interviews are Zoom or they're a phone, call, something like that. So I'll do the introduction. I'll introduce the candidate to the hiring manager. And then I just mute my phone or I turn off the video and mute my Zoom. And I observe the interview because what I want to see is, here's what they say is important, but here's the questions they're actually asking. Are they on point? A lot of times they are. A lot of times they're actually going right down the job description. Most of the time they're going through the person's resume. And I feel like, okay, well, the resume was in print. You've had that for a couple of weeks. We could have already known that. If there's some questions you needed answered as to why did you transition from, firm A to firm B, maybe there's a 3-month gap on the resume. Those are important questions to ask. But as a recruiter, I try to handle all of those up front. So I'm never really quite sure. I think it's just kind of a warm up. You're just sort of acclimating to someone's personality. And it's like a cocktail party. You're asking them sort of basic questions. But once we get into the meat of things, I want to make sure they're on point and they're asking questions that actually pertain to the job. So that's my biggest thing with hiring managers. With candidates, my biggest thing that I coach on is getting to know the company. I require every person that I submit to study a minimum of 2 hours on the website of the company that they're going to interview for. And I'll ask them some basic questions. Some of it is almost like a history test. When were they formed? Who's the president? What charities are they involved with? If it's on there. But I just want to make sure that when they go into the interview, they don't seem like someone who pulled up the company on their phone, 5 minutes before they decided to talk. And so getting to know and acclimate, and then beyond that, go forward. And the beautiful thing is we have LinkedIn now, where you could see who you're interviewing with. You could see what jobs they've had before, where they went to college, maybe see who they're connected to that you are, find out if you have some commonality. Because at the end of the day, once we've checked the boxes on whether or not you're competent for the role, it is a personality test, as to who they're going to hire. And so getting people to be able to get to that personality and show that, the quickest way to do that is to show someone that you care and that you put in the time to learn who they were, what their company represents, et cetera. So a lot of times I'm working on a candidate, just making sure that they're as sharp as a tack when they go in. I can't help whether or not they're likable. People are who they are, but I can, make sure that they've done their business, they're polished, and that they can create some synergies between them and the hiring manager that might warm things up to go to the next stage. So yeah, I'm always coaching on both sides, John. And some people it just comes real natural and some people are more robotic. And so you kind of have to coach to that.
Right, absolutely. No, that makes perfect sense. And it all boils down to really creating the environment where it's a two-way conversation at the end of the day. It's not just one-sided that only one, the hiring organization only asks the questions, but also giving the opportunity for the candidate to get their input, provide, ask the questions that they would like. So it's an always interesting dynamic from that standpoint.
Yeah, I call it the San Antonio test. And that's because I live and work in Fort Worth, Texas. And Fort Worth to San Antonio, depending on how you drive, is around 5 hours. And the San Antonio test is, could you get in a car, drive to San Antonio with the candidate, and when you got there, would you need a break? Or would you be like, hey, let's grab a beer, let's grab some lunch or something like that, like wanting to be around them more. And so if someone can pass the San Antonio test, in my mind, they're probably the one who's going to get the job. Because at the end of the day, people do hire who they like. But we've got to cross off all of the, all of the necessary things in order to get there for sure.
Right. Absolutely. No, I love that. When it comes to your personal, I guess, the sources that you use for self-actualization and learning, what's your content diet is looking like these days? So share with us your sources for learning. What do you let your mind be exposed to these days?
Yeah. So, with the advent of podcasts like this one, listening to business leaders, that type of thing, the three things that I've done is there's a cognitive psychologist who works with sport teams, such as the University of Alabama and the Pittsburgh Steelers. His name is Dr. Kevin Elko, E-L-K-O. And I've been working with him A lot of what he does is on actualization and self-belief. It's like setting goals, saying the goals out loud, being already in the past tense of, you know, being sort of, you know, he's a spiritual guy. So a lot of times he's talking about prayer, but talking from a standpoint of having already accomplished that. You know, thank you for this. And it's a goal that you want to achieve, but you're thanking it as if it's already happened. So sort of actualizing it in your mind. I was sort of raised in a position in which there was a lot of negative self-talk in my family. And so that sort of came naturally to me. And so working with Dr. Elko has kind of helped me shape my mind and how you look at opportunities. Another thing that I'm a big believer in with me personally is regional conferences. I recruit in the financial services space. And so if there's family offices or asset management conferences, I like to hear what the innovators are doing. And so I'll go attend that conference and listen in. Sometimes you get good investment ideas, but more and more what you're doing is you're meeting the leaders of the industry and you're hearing how their mind works. So attending conferences, I've found to be very, you know, very beneficial. And then you, without having to get out and pay those large fees and things of that nature to go to a conference, a lot of people will let you sign up for their newsletters for free. And so companies that I admire, chief investment officers that have, you know, interesting opinions or that I see on CNBC or something like that, I'll go to their website, see if they have a newsletter and click on that. And that's been the first 30 minutes of my workday, just going through newsletters of industry leaders or firms that I admire and just trying to get on their wavelength and see what problems they're trying to solve. Just knowing that if the leaders are doing that, then everyone else is going to be dealing with that at some point.
No, that's great. And thanks for sharing that's the framework that you use from that perspective. And we'll list some of those sources in the show notes. In conclusion, I always ask if there is a particular book that you always recommend to others. And if so, what is it and why do you recommend it?
Yeah, there's a book that I've bought over 50 copies of in my lifetime. And I send them out to people who are at an inflection point in their business. Maybe it's been a business that they've had for a long time and they've stagnated their growth and just can't seem to push through. Or I will recommend it to someone who wants an outsider's point of view to come into their organization. A lot of times people come to me and they say, you know, Blair, we've had an orange in this position for a long time. We'd like another orange. And that's usually what I'm doing. But occasionally I meet with someone who is ready for someone with a different perspective to come to into their organization. And the book that I recommend is called American Icon. It's by Bryce Hoffman. And Bryce wrote a book as Ford Motor Company hired the COO from Boeing to come over to Ford Motor Company and become their chief executive officer. And everyone in the automotive industry said, this is going to be an abject failure. You can't bring someone from the defense and aeronautical industries into, you know, this business. They'll just never understand it. They won't get it. This is going to be a huge failure. And it was absolutely the opposite. The level of engagement that he brought in across channels, the buy-in that he got from his organization, the ability to weed out people who had been there a long time, but we're no longer, you know, pushing the envelope or moving Ford Motor Company forward, and to be able to make hard decisions because he was an outsider and he wasn't emotionally held to, you know, Joe Schmo's, you know, career longevity at Ford. And he was able to see it from an outsider's point of view and the results that he ended up having. I just think it's a brilliant, you know, Bryce did a good job of integrating himself into Ford Motor Company and following them. You're in business meetings with them. You're in board meetings. You're at the lunchroom, you know, along with people and along the journey of reading this book. And it's a fabulous story of a turnaround, but it's also a fabulous story on sometimes needing to look beyond what you know in order to gain an outsider's perspective. So American Icon by Bryce Hoffman, I strongly recommend.
Oh, that's awesome. Love that recommendation. Gonna add that to my growing list of books that I have to read on because I get so many recommendations, and we'll make that recommendation available in show notes. Blair, can't thank you enough for your generous insights today. Personally learned quite a bit. we're going to stay in touch and perhaps do another episode in a year or so to see how much have transpired. So definitely looking forward to that.
That'd be great, John. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.